Blowjob. He looked back at the girl starting on another guy. Is she gonna remember any of this? Probably not. And even if she does, she won't. If you know what I mean. Greg looked at his watch. Listen, meet me back at the car at 3 a.m. sharp. I've gotta meet the Filipinos. Hyder nodded absently, still watching the girl work. Greg punched his arm. Ow! I mean it. Meet me at the car at 3 a.m. sharp, or you'll have to bum a ride off the Albanian mob. Got it? All right, I got it. Now if you'll excuse me. At that, Hyder stepped away to join the circle of men. By 3:15 a.m., Greg and Hyder were back on the Katy Freeway heading east. Hyder was leaning against the passenger door, fucked up out of his mind.
That MPEG video over at the dance floor? It showed Rams butting heads! Butting their heads! Their fucking heads!
He was weeping, but then suddenly erupted into uncontrollable laughter. He was apparently laughing about having just been crying. Greg focused on driving. He headed north and east for a half hour or so, and then exited in a seedy industrial district amid rail sidings. They rattled along potholed streets. With each bone-shuddering bump, Greg winced. The ground effects on his SI were going to get thrashed at this rate. He also felt like a prime carjacking target in this industrial wasteland. Yet as he looked around the deserted factory streets, it didn't look like a popular gang hangout. The streets were too broken and crisscrossed with railroad sidings for the street racing scene. Before long, Greg found the street he was looking for. He turned down the dead end and parked next to a rusted chain-link fence topped with brand-new razor wire. It enclosed flatbed tractor trailers in various stages of decay. At the end of the street stood a brick factory building marked Industrial Laundry Corp. in faded paint. The windows near the roof glowed with fluorescent light from within, and the double doors near the loading dock were open wide, letting a wedge of light splay out across the weed-encrusted sidewalk. Signs in some Asian script covered the backs of both open doors. A couple of men in white aprons smoked out front, apparently on break. Greg turned off the car and looked at Hyder's dozing form. He quietly pulled a piece of paper from his own jacket pocket and glanced at the code number written on it in pen. He took his car keys from the ignition and carefully slipped them into Hyder's pocket. It wasn't difficult. In fact, he hoped he could still rouse Hyder, who was out cold. He nudged him. No response. He shoved Hyder, then finally shook him.
Hyder, man, wake up!
Hyder awoke slowly, still high out of his mind.
What the fuck, man?
I need you to pick up the new encryption key from my contact.
He's in there, he pointed.
Hyder squinted and looked back at him like he was insane.
Fuck you, man, you go.
Hyder, take a look around you. I'm not leaving my car sitting out here, and you'll fall asleep the minute I'm gone. You know what I put into this ride?
Well then, why the fuck did you park a mile away, asshole?
A semi was just in the loading dock.
Well, I don't know who your fucking contact is.
Just give them this code number. Greg handed him the piece of paper. They won't even ask who you are. You're just picking up the code. Hyder wavered fuzzily, trying to process what Greg had just said. Greg sighed impatiently.
Christ, Jace, why do I have to do everything? I arrange the business, I keep you supplied with new gear, and I got you laid tonight.
Hyder conceded this by nodding reluctantly.
When are you going to start pulling your weight, man?
Hyder squinted at the two dumpy middle-aged Asians smoking and chatting 200 feet away. Greg pointed.
Oh, they sure look dangerous. Fuck! All right, just don't do this shit to me without telling me first, man. I don't like surprises.
Hyder exchanged a last serious look with Greg. Greg just rolled his eyes. Hyder sighed and got out. Greg watched Hyder stagger down the street toward the lighted factory door less than a football field away. Once Hyder was gone, Greg grabbed his own backpack and quietly got out of the car. He slipped behind two dumpsters and from the darkness watched Hyder approach the men. The Asian men watched impassively as Hyder labored up to them. Hyder said something and handed the piece of paper to the nearest guy. After reading it, the man pointed toward the open doorway. Hyder walked through and stood silhouetted for a moment before one of the men walked in after him and shoved him forward. The other man scanned the street, threw his cigarette to the ground, and then walked inside, pulling the doors shut behind him. They closed with a resounding bang, leaving the street dark and quiet. Greg knelt down, shivering now in the cold autumn air. He waited for about a half hour before he heard the doors open again. Footsteps clacked across the pavement heading his way. Greg knew that Hyder never wore anything that could remotely clack on pavement, so he hunkered down as a younger Filipino in slacks and a sport coat walked past the opening between the dumpsters. Greg heard his own car alarm chirp off, and the man got inside. He started the car up, raced the engine a bit, and then peeled off in a wild, squealing U-turn back down the street. Greg slumped down against the brick wall behind the dumpsters. He felt the cold of the brick seep into his back. Maybe he shouldn't have hijacked the Filipino's web server. Why couldn't he have left well enough alone? How had they caught on? Damn, they got my car! Thank God it was registered under a false name. Greg sighed and took out his GPS receiver. He found the nearest cross street on the map, then flipped open his phone and selected a saved number. After a few rings, it picked up. Yeah, I need a cab. Chapter 5, Icarus 7. John Ross raced his Audi A8 sedan onto the Alcyon Insurance corporate campus, then quickly slowed down as he noticed several police cruisers and unmarked cars near the lobby doors. He turned down his music, a relentlessly pounding techno track, and motored at a more civilized speed past the squad cars. Interesting. No flashing lights, though. Ross headed for the parking garage. In a few minutes, he was echoing across the granite-floored lobby, approaching the security desk. Hey, Alejandro. Alejandro smiled. John, my boy, how you doing tonight? Ross swiped his consultant's badge and signed the after-hours access list. What's with the police cars? Oh, there was a computer break-in. The cops are down in the data center. Ross stopped writing. He looked up. A break-in? Yeah, it's something what these people can do. It's all computers nowadays. Alejandro leaned closer to Ross. Ted Winnick was asking about you. I won't tell nobody I saw you if you want to clear out. Ross finished signing in. He smiled. Thanks, but not necessary. It was probably some 12-year-old kid. Ross headed down the clean white corridor of B2. Soon he reached the accounting department's data center and slid his badge through the reader. The door clicked open, and he moved briskly toward his office at the far wall. Then he slowed. The lights were on in his office. He forced himself not to stop, and instead resumed a normal walking pace. He opened his office door and was greeted by the sight of two severely groomed men in inexpensive suits and comfortable shoes, sitting on the edge of his desk. One was a Latino, the other Caucasian, but they shared the same humorless expression. Hadi Sarkar, the night shift data center supervisor, sat at Ross's keyboard, pecking away behind them. He turned somewhat sheepishly to face Ross. One of the clean-cut men reached into his jacket and withdrew credentials, which he flipped open.
Jonathan Ross?
Yes?
I'm Special Agent Straub. This is Special Agent Vasquez. We'd like to ask you a few questions about last night. Your colleague, Hadi, here has been able to shed some light on things, but he tells us you're the real expert.
Ross glared at Sarkar and put his laptop case down on the desk.
I'm happy to help any way I can. What's all this about? You were present in Alcyon's data center last night?
I was working under contract for another department, but Hadi requested my help. His development servers had become infected with what appeared to be a kernel rootkit.
And you have experience with computer viruses?
Ross paused. He had to be careful here.
Look, I'm a database consultant. Computer security is part of my job. I know what I need to know.
Why did you make Hadi and his co-workers promise not to tell anyone about your help?
Because I was breaking the rules to help Hadi. That endangered my contract here. I made that clear to him.
So you were asking Hadi to lie on your behalf?
I was asking him not to tell people that I was doing his job.
Sarkar jumped in.
I was requesting advice merely, John.
Ross folded his arms.
Hadi, your exact words were that you had tried everything you could think of and wanted my help.
He turned back to Agent Straub. A rogue process somewhere in his data center was broadcasting packets to the web last night. Hadi couldn't find it. The process was incredibly stealthy, possibly a kernel rootkit.
Sarkar shook his head emphatically.
There is no way to hide the source of network traffic, John. I told you this.
Well, the testbed servers were definitely involved. Test servers are usually the weakest on security. They have beta software and they're frequently reconfigured. So I had Hadi kill Icarus servers 1 through 10 and the packet broadcast stopped, even though it wasn't supposed to be originating from there.
Agent Straub nodded, taking notes. So you knew right where to look, then?
That wasn't my point.
Agent Vasquez ignored the discussion and picked up the phone. He dialed while Ross glanced at the computer screen. Sarkar had the event viewer maximized.
I see we're starting the hunt on my machine.
Straub slid his credentials back into his suit pocket.
We haven't ruled out an inside job.
Of course. Forget the fact that I was the one who advised Hadi to shut that system down. Hardly something I'd do if I was the one running the exploit.
You might if you realized it had been discovered. It seems convenient that due to your involvement, the hard drives were erased.
Ross was poker-faced.
The rootkit destroyed the machine when I tried to shut it down. In any event, FBI forensics can reconstruct data from a wiped drive.
Vasquez hung up the phone.
They want us in the main data center.
As they moved down the hallway, Sarkar kept groaning softly and shaking his head. Ross didn't take the bait. Sarkar finally muttered,
John, I had no choice but to tell them.
Hadi, I've been in this business long enough to know better.
Ross knew that no good deed goes unpunished, and though he hadn't technically done anything wrong, helping Sarkar out with his little problem could result in the loss of his contract with Alcyon. Or worse, he thought, eyeing their FBI escort.
They were asking questions about what we did. This is the FBI, not human resources. They talked to us separately, and I knew that Maynard would mention you. John, what was I supposed to do? I do not wish to get deported.
Ross grimaced.
I should have known better than to get involved, Hadi.
I am not a Muslim. I am a Hindu. You will tell them, won't you?
Ross didn't respond. Sarkar looked genuinely pained.
I am sorry, John.
Ted Winnick probably called the feds into Force Accounting's hand and have my contract canceled. He doesn't like having people down here who don't answer to him.
Ted didn't call the FBI, John.
Then who did, you?
No one did.
Ross stopped walking.
What do you mean?
They came here on their own, because of what the Icarus 7 server did.
Ross looked back to the FBI agents. Straub motioned for him to keep moving.
Just what have I gotten involved in here?
Ross wondered. There were a lot of people in the data center. It was almost acceptably warm as a result. Sarkar's boss, Ted Winnick, leaned against a counter, glowering beneath thick eyebrows as he listened to two techs Ross hadn't seen before. This was probably the A-team, the daytime shift. They looked at Ross with the special contempt reserved for young consultants. Half a dozen uniformed Woodland Hills police officers were in here along with more FBI agents. They were talking with a network admin, a pear-shaped guy with bad skin. He was probably Maynard. Pear-shaped pointed at various server racks enthusiastically. At least someone was enjoying this.
What happened?
As soon as Ross entered the room, everyone stopped talking and turned to face him. The sudden silence was almost embarrassing because Ross knew he had none of the answers they were looking for. He decided to ask the obvious question.
Anybody want to tell me what's going on?
All eyes turned to someone behind Ross, so he spun on his heel to face a trim man in a crisp suit. The guy looked like a 50-year-old varsity quarterback, a leader of men.
Mr. Ross, I'm Special Agent Neil Decker, L.A. Division. Do you know why we're here?
Because of last night?
Decker sized him up. It unnerved Ross that no one was talking. But Decker was in no hurry. He finally placed his hand on a disconnected rack server sitting on the nearby counter.
They tell me this computer killed two men earlier today.
The shock took a while to work through Ross. He had expected some sort of child pornography ring or a credit card scam.
Killed? How?
I was hoping you could help us explain that.
Why on earth would you think that?
Decker smiled good-naturedly.
A lot of people are suspects right now, but once we get the people in here to help us interpret the evidence, we'll know more. In the meantime, we'd like to take you gentlemen in for questioning. His gaze spanned the room to include all the men who were present during the incident. A wave of dread washed over Ross. We're not under arrest? No, I'm asking you to voluntarily come in for questioning. Ross wondered what would happen if he said no. Of course, he couldn't say no.
What about a lawyer?
I must tell you, I'm just completely floored by this.
I'm certain you are.
This guy was disconcertingly calm. He gave the impression that he knew more than he was letting on.
God damn it.
Just then a man appeared at the glass data center door. He was the linebacker to match Decker as a quarterback. His casual confidence seemed to indicate he wasn't FBI. The agents here were all keyed up in Decker's presence. No, this guy was an outsider to them. The man rapped on the glass, and a Woodland Hills patrolman opened the door for him. The newcomer showed a badge and was let inside.
I'm looking for an Agent Decker.
Decker and the FBI agents turned and moved forward, hands extended.
Detective Seebeck, we spoke on the phone.
They shook hands. Decker turned to some of his crew.
Agent Knowles, Agent Straub, Detective Sergeant Peter Seebeck, Ventura County Major Crimes Unit. Detective Seebeck was heading the murder investigation up in Thousand Oaks.
Handshakes all around. Then everyone turned back to Ross. Seebeck pointed at him.
Who's this?
Decker leaned against the counter.
This is John Ross, one of Alcyon's independent computer consultants. He designs their corporate data systems. Isn't that right, Mr. Ross?
Certain systems, yes, not this one.
Is he a suspect or a witness?
Ross thought it was a good question. Decker was calm as ever.
That depends.
He looked to Ross.
Tell me, Mr. Ross, why is it that no one at your home address has ever heard of you?
Damn it to hell, thought Ross.
Chapter 6, Exile.
Ms. Anderson?
The security guard stepped from the guard shack and ducked to look in the Jaguar XK8. Angie Anderson looked down her nose at him from behind the wheel, lowering her Vuitton sunglasses.
Yes, open the gate.
Ma'am, if you could drive off to the right here, I believe Mr. Langley wants to have a word with you.
I think you should open the gate.
Ma'am, Mr. Langley...
Mr. Langley, whoever that is, can call my office if he wants to speak with me.
She dug through her glove compartment and produced a drive-on studio pass.
Now, open the gate.
Ma'am, I'm afraid you're just going to have to pull off to the right there.
Why? Do you know who I am?
He gave her an incredulous look. He obviously knew who she was.
And why do you keep calling me ma'am? What is this, the Ponderosa? My name is Angie Anderson, although later you'll be calling me that bitch who got me fired.
Ma'am, there's no call for cussing.
Cussing? Okay, Clem, I won't cuss no more as long as you open the fucking gate.
His look hardened. He leaned down closer. Look, if you don't pull off to the right, you'll wish you had. Now park over there. He pointed. She just laughed.
Ah, I guess there's only so much shit you'll take for $8 an hour, eh?
Pull over to the right. A car behind her honked.
And what if I don't?
Pull over to the right. Another guard approached the car.
Oh, you called for backup. You need protection from a helpless woman, Clem?
The second guard eased the first away from the car and then turned to her.
Ms. Anderson, using your superior social position to belittle a powerless employee does not speak well of you.
She stared at him.
The fact is that we've been instructed by your superiors to prevent you from entering. If you want to know why, I suggest you pull over to the right.
She nodded slowly and put the car in gear.
Okay, I will.
She yanked the steering wheel to the right and accelerated madly into the walk-on lot. Anderson was burning with anger after walking in high heels from the far corner of the parking lot. She was going to raise hell about this with Walter Kahn. She was talent. She shouldn't have to put up with facilities crap. When she finally reached the guard shed again, the second guard pointed to a pedestrian gate where two people waited for her. One, a trim woman in a tailored suit, the other, another security guard. Anderson slowed down and then stopped. She stood there, not liking what she was suddenly thinking. The woman motioned for her to approach. Anderson took a deep breath and walked up to them as composed as she could manage.
What's this all about?
The woman extended her hand from between the bars. It was like visiting hours at the state pen. Anderson extended her own hand for a cold handshake.
Ms. Anderson, I'm Josephine Curto from Human Resources. There's been a change in your contract status at the network. My agent is negotiating a contract renewal. It doesn't lapse for another 5 weeks. Yes, I see. Those negotiations are over. The network decided not to renew your contract. Please understand, this decision came down from corporate. I'm just delivering the news. We thought your agent would have told you.
Anderson felt the tears welling up, but sucked in a breath and forced them back down again. She looked away and pressed her forefinger and thumb against the bridge of her nose, then looked back sharply at Curto.
This is how you decide to tell me I'm fired? I'm standing here like some kind of vagrant in the street. What am I, a threat? What am I going to do, shoot up the place?
Curto was unperturbed as she attached papers to a clipboard.
That's not the concern. You are known to studio personnel and have access to a live television broadcast. I'm sure you can appreciate that the network doesn't want you getting on the air at this difficult time. Difficult time?
Anderson tried in vain to form her thoughts into words several times. The tears threatened again. She finally blurted out lamely,
I have fans. You've seen my fan mail? There are men and women in Marin and Oakland and Walnut Creek, people who've asked to marry me. What are you going to tell them about my sudden disappearance? I have no idea how to respond to that question. You should let me do a final broadcast. Lifestyles reporters don't get farewell broadcasts, Ms. Anderson. What about Jim McEwen? They had a big send-off when he retired. Jim was the anchor. He worked at the studio for 32 years. You've been here 6. This is no way to treat talent. That's hardly at issue here.
Anderson realized Curto was smart for being on the other side of the bars. She took another deep breath and tried to center herself.
Can't I at least go in to say goodbye to Jamie and Doug and the others? Oh, see, now why are we having this conversation? It's not productive,
Curto said. She pushed a clipboard and pen through the bars.
Can you please sign these?
Anderson just stared at her indignantly.
I'm not signing anything. You want your personal effects, right? My personal effects? You mean you people emptied out my office?
Angie, what do you think is going on here?
This is a large corporation with global responsibilities. Emptying out your office wasn't a vengeful act. It was a work order. Just sign the documents and let's get this over with. This is not fun for you or me.
Anderson grabbed the clipboard and pen. She slapped it against the bars right in front of Curto's face and started reading the Cobra and 401k documents. She felt like a public spectacle, a loser standing outside the gates where everyone could see her. The grips and cameramen stared as they drove in through the nearby gate. She started tearing up in humiliation. Someone was punishing her. But who? She finally signed all the papers without reading them and shoved the clipboard back through the bars.
We'll deliver your personal effects to your home.
Anderson hurried away, rushing for the distant refuge of her car.
Ms. Anderson, my pen.
Anderson had been a starting pitcher on Wisconsin State's girls softball team. She stopped, turned, and hurled the pen at the corporate ice bitch with all her strength. The woman took it right in the torso. Had it been a Mont Blanc, she would have been sucking for air. But it was just a Bic, and the woman shrunk back.
There's no call for that.
Anderson stormed away, her mind running in a fast forward to all the bad things that were sure to follow. Someone had dynamited a bridge on her road to success. She hadn't prepared for this at all. Fucking terrorists. She mentally ticked off a list of her friends. They were all in the business or attached to the business. Who could find her a soft landing at another station? If not in San Francisco, then where? Not Madison, Wisconsin again, please, dear God. Then it hit her that Melanie hadn't warned her. That bitch had let her be publicly humiliated. Anderson pulled her cell phone out of her handbag and speed-dialed her agent. It rang 3 times and went to voicemail.
You've reached the office of Melanie Smalls. Ms. Smalls is not available at the moment. To reach her assistant, Jason Karcher, press 3349.
Anderson punched in the numbers.
Ms. Smalls' office, can I help you? Jason, it's Angie Anderson. Put me through to Melanie.
Hi, Ms. Anderson. Melanie's on another line. Do you want to hold?
Look, I'm standing out in front of KTLZ, and they've locked me out of the studio. Get Melanie on the damn phone. Okay, hang on.
Anderson reached her car and clicked the remote. She got inside and cleaned up her mascara in the rearview mirror, while Barry Manilow tortured her on hold because it looked like she had emphatically not made it, the anger built inside her with each passing verse. Finally, Melanie clicked on.
Angie, what's going on?
I've just been fired at the studio front gate, publicly humiliated. Josephine Curto tells me that you knew my contract wasn't being picked up.
Who the hell's Josephine Curto?
Some toady from Human Resources.
Angie, we're still in negotiations with the network, and I wasn't told that any decision had been made. The ball was still in Khan's court.
Josephine just told me that my agent knew about this, Melanie. I just signed papers.
Well, she doesn't know what the hell she's talking about. And what do you mean you just signed papers? Why would you sign papers?
Melanie's voice became muted.
Chase, check the fax machine.
Anderson started crying again. She hit the dashboard, angry with herself for being so emotional.
Damn it, Melanie! Why didn't I see this coming? Who the hell did the network get to replace me?
Don't beat yourself up. We'll see if we can get you something on the E-Channel or...
No, stop! I've been trying for 6 years to get on a serious news desk. I can't afford to do any more fluff pieces. I'm a journalist, not a damn fashion model.
There was silence on the other end.
Hello?
I'm still here. Angie, you don't have the right pedigree for it. You haven't been a journalist, honey, not really. And you weren't talking serious journalism when we got you onto the San Francisco affiliate.
I'm realizing...
You're realizing you're past 30 and fluff reporting is for 24-year-old news models.
Exactly.
That's a problem.
No, it's a challenge.
Angie, what you're talking about is starting back at square one and reinventing yourself. No, actually, you're starting at square negative one because you're already known as a fashion and lifestyles reporter, meaning you have all the journalistic heft of a British tabloid. It's going to be a stretch, and at my age, I don't stretch.
Anderson searched for words. This was unraveling fast.
Honey, you're too old to intern as a serious journalist. Unless you're a proven hard news reporter at 30, you're not going to be a hard news reporter.
Anderson bit her lip gently. Performed in front of the right man, that used to solve a lot of problems. She realized that Christiane Amanpour probably didn't bite her lip.
Unfortunately, major networks are consolidating news production in Atlanta and laying off in most markets. I could try to get you a spot on a cosmetics infomercial casting in L.A.
Tears flowed down Anderson's cheeks. Chapter 7. Demon.
Yahoo.com News. E-murder at video game company, Thousand Oaks, California. A booby trap sprung via the internet claimed the life of a Cyberstorm Entertainment employee Thursday. An off-site death earlier in the day is also under investigation as a related homicide. Programmer Chopra Singh, project lead on the best-selling MMORPG game The Gate, was electrocuted in company offices. Lead Detective Peter Seebeck of the Ventura County Sheriff's Major Crimes Unit confirmed the killings were carried out via the internet.
Seebeck was already staring at the ceiling when his alarm clock sounded. He switched it off by touch and kept staring at the ceiling. He'd gotten in late last night. Even so, he hadn't slept. He kept turning the case over in his mind. That's what he'd taken to calling it, the case. The FBI had taken over. They were forming a temporary task force with local law enforcement, but the feds were in charge. Agents were photocopying files and interrogating suspects when Seebeck left at 2 a.m. Decker was some sort of workaholic. Seebeck explored his sense of loss. The case no longer belonged to him. Why did it bother him so much? He was afraid he knew the answer. He only felt truly alive when something horrible was happening. That was the dirty secret behind every promotion he had ever received. He'd miscast himself in the role of authority figure, a decision made one afternoon 15 years ago. He had had to grow up fast back then, after the baby, but he sometimes wondered if he wasn't just pretending, if he wasn't simply acting the way he thought he should act, the way others around him did. He didn't even know who he'd be without this role. Pete Seebeck was just an idea, a collection of responsibilities with a mailing address.
He tried to recall the last time he actually felt something, the last time he felt alive.
That inevitably led to thoughts of her, memories of the trip to Grand Cayman. He tried to remember the smell of her hair. He wondered where she was right now and if he'd ever see her again. She didn't need a damn thing from him. Maybe that's what he loved most about her.
Seebeck's cell phone sounded from the nightstand, scattering his thoughts. He glanced over at his wife's side of the bed. She roused slightly. He grabbed the handset and sat up.
Seebeck.
Detective Seebeck?
Yeah, this is Special Agent Borner, FBI. I just sent an email to your home address. The agent in charge wants a response before you're in this morning.
Someone yelled in the background. Borner clicked off without saying goodbye.
Hello?
Seebeck stared in irritation at the handset.
Rude asshole.
He glanced at the clock, 6:32 a.m. His wife sat up on the other side of the bed and stretched in one of her full-length nightgowns.
Laura, I have to jump in the shower first. I've got a full day ahead.
Fine, Pete.
I won't be long. Go back to sleep.
Seebeck ran through his ablutions in 15 minutes, dressed, and tied his tie on the way downstairs. He ducked into the kitchen. His son, Chris, sat reading the morning paper.
The kid was getting big, muscular big.
16. Almost the age Seebeck was when he and Laura conceived the boy.
Had it really been 16 years?
Why don't you get a shovel, Chris?
Chris had a bulging mouthful of cereal. The boy grabbed at his dad's suit jacket as he walked past. Chris flipped the paper over to reveal the front page. There was a color picture of Seebeck over the headline, Internet Killings Spark Federal Investigation. Mance was also in the picture to his left. Seebeck stopped short and picked up the page, reading slowly as he sank down into a seat at the table. Chris chewed his way back to speech.
L.A. Times, that's big!
Seebeck just kept reading. Laura walked into the kitchen. Seebeck glanced up.
Did you see this?
She looked down at the page.
Not a great picture of Nathan.
She went over to the stove to make tea. Seebeck handed the paper back to Chris, but kept looking at Laura.
I won't be able to pick up Chris from practice today. I've got the FBI here, the national media, and God knows what else.
We'll manage.
Chris lowered the paper.
The feds are interrogating the insurance guys. You think they did it?
I'm not the one questioning them, Chris.
Seebeck stood.
From here on out, I'll be lucky to be in the loop at all.
He glanced at his watch.
I gotta go.
Seebeck headed down the hall to the den. Once there, he dropped into the desk chair and hit the power switch on the computer. While the computer booted, he moved a gaming joystick off to the side and tossed two soda cans in the trash. He called to the kitchen.
Chris! I won't keep asking you to clean up in here when you're done!
No answer. The computer desktop came up. Seebeck launched his email program, then clicked the Get Mail button. He waited as 132 messages downloaded.
Goddamn spam.
When it finished, the message subject lines ranged from
Barely Legal Teens
to
Nigerian Exile Needs Help
to
Lolitas Take Horsecock.
He searched his inbox for the FBI message. It was near the top and had the subject line Case Number 93233 Cyberstorm/Pavlos from BornerH@FBI.gov. Seebeck double-clicked on it. Strangely, as the email opened, the screen went black. Then the words, testing audio, faded in. The hard drive strained. Seebeck stared in confusion.
What did he do?
In a moment, the words faded out and were replaced by a grainy video image of a man. It was hard to tell his age or precise appearance due to the poor video quality. It was amateurish, poorly lit, and off-center. The man looked thin and pale, a condition emphasized by his standing against a featureless white background. He was completely bald and wore what looked to be a medical gown.
What the hell was this? Some sort of FBI lab report?
It took Seebeck a moment to realize that the video was already playing. The man swayed unsteadily, his pixels adjusting like colored tiles. Then he looked directly into the camera and nodded as if in greeting.
Detective Seebeck. I was Matthew Sobel. Chief Technology Officer of Cyberstorm Entertainment. I am dead.
Seebeck leaned forward, his eyes fixed on the monitor.
I see you've been assigned to the Joseph Pavlos and Chopra Singh murder cases. Let me save you some time. I killed both men. Soon you'll know why, but you have a problem. Because I'm dead, you can't arrest me. More importantly, you can't stop me.
Seebeck stared in stunned silence. Sobel continued.
Since you have no choice but to try and stop me, I want to take this moment to wish you luck, Sergeant. Because you're going to need it.
The image disappeared, revealing the email inbox again. Seebeck didn't move for several moments. When he finally did, it was to forward the message to his sheriff's email address. Chapter 8. Escalation.
Mr. Ross, help us to understand this. You have no permanent address, and yet you've got nearly $300,000 in liquid assets. Am I to believe you live with your parents?
John Ross rubbed his tired eyes and tried to concentrate on the question. The same question they'd asked 22 different ways. The one they kept coming back to. The taller FBI agent leaned in close.
Mr. Ross?
I'm a contract nomad. Ancient people followed caribou. I follow software contracts.
The shorter agent stood next to a mirrored window and flipped through his notes.
You've been at Alcyon Insurance for, what, 2 months now? Is that a long time for you?
Not particularly. 3 or 4 is typical.
Your clients gave us various physical addresses for your business. It's kind of strange for a one-man corporation, isn't it?
Ross ran his fingers through his hair in frustration.
You contacted my clients? Are you trying to destroy my business?
Why are you concealing information from your clients?
I maintain contact addresses legally through resident agents in several states. This is legal commerce. Why are you guys doing this to me? I was trying to help Hadi.
That doesn't explain why you have a phony personal address.
Ross sighed.
I had the fake address because society requires everyone to have a permanent home address.
Then why don't you have one?
Because I don't need one.
Both agents were pacing again. The shorter one was the first to speak.
Single? No property? Do you pay all your taxes, Mr. Ross?
I'm a Delaware service corporation. I pay myself a reasonable salary, max out my 401k, and take the remainder as corporate profits, minus travel and business expenses. And the corporation leases my car.
He hesitated.
Look, I didn't do anything wrong. I was trying to help my client.
The phone in the center of the table rang. The shorter agent grabbed it without saying a word. He listened. After a few moments, he nodded slightly and looked at Ross with some surprise.
Understood.
A pause.
Yes.
He hung up.
Looks like you're off the hook, Mr. Ross.
Neil Decker and three other FBI agents sat in the darkened training room of the East County Sheriff's headquarters, intently watching a screen projection of Sobel's MPEG video. Seebeck, Mance, Burkow, and Ventura County's assistant chief, Stan Eichhorn, watched alongside them. Aaron Larson ran the video off a laptop hooked to the department's digital projector. Sobel's grainy image glowed on screen.
I'd like to take this moment to wish you luck, Sergeant, because you're going to need it.
The image froze, and Sobel's audience whistled and broke out into raucous discussion. Larson brought up the lights, revealing Agent Decker staring intently at the blank screen. He finally came around and stepped to the front of the room.
Gentlemen, this changes things.
Decker looked to Agent Straub.
When does the computer forensics team get in, Tom?
They're already en route from Oxnard Airport.
Get them over to Cyberstorm as soon as they arrive. Where are the Alcyon insurance computers?
Put on a plane to D.C. last night.
Good. Hopefully they'll get something off the drives. In the meantime, have the forensics team comb through the Cyberstorm network. I want it sniffed for booby traps, and then we need to shift our focus to Matthew Sobel.
He pointed to the projector.
Get forensics a copy of this video file.
Larson perked up.
I burned copies onto CD. I can make more if you need them.
Decker held up his hands.
That brings up an important point. I want absolute secrecy concerning this case.
He looked to the local police.
That means no talking to friends and relatives, and absolutely no talking to the media. We need to control what information gets out there.
Seebeck pointed at the screen.
Has anyone heard of this Sobel guy?
Decker didn't say anything. He just fished through folders on a nearby tabletop and then slid a folder over to Seebeck. It was labeled Matthew Andrew Sobel.
What, you already knew about him?
Died Thursday. We thought he might be another victim, but he died of brain cancer. He's been ill for years. He was a company founder, had access to everything. It all fits except for the motive. Straub picked up from there. They were like an old married couple.
His assistant said Sobel suffered from dementia. He was paranoid and secretive. It got worse as his illness progressed. He finally had to stop working last year.
Seebeck flipped through the folder. It was filled with medical files and psychology reports.
Did he have the know-how to build that booby trap over at Cyberstorm?
Decker and Straub exchanged knowing glances. Decker took the folder back.
Sobel scored 220 on an IQ test in 1993. The NSA tried to recruit him out of Stanford for his dissertation on polymorphic data encryption. Instead, he started a game company and made millions by his early 20s. He was plenty capable.
Seebeck knew he could either accept it or say something. He pondered it for several more moments before he decided to make an ass out of himself by speaking up.
What about the phone call from that fictitious FBI agent? There's someone else involved in this.
We've got good technical people, Sergeant. Let's see what they find, but I'll need wiretaps on your cell, office, and home phones. He turned to Straub. Let's also get Seebeck's ISP to forward all incoming email to the forensics unit. Sergeant, can I expect your cooperation? Seebeck nodded.
Yeah, let me tell my wife and kid, but yes, of course.
Straub wrote on a small notepad.
I'll need your signature on some paperwork.
Seebeck drummed his fingers on the table impatiently.
Look, I don't doubt that this Sobel guy was brilliant, but I'm not convinced that that grainy video is Matthew Sobel. If he was such a genius, he sure as hell could take a clearer video than that. I can't even make out his face all that well.
A murmur of agreement swept through the room. Decker was unperturbed.
We'll have it analyzed by experts.
Seebeck still pushed.
I think a Cyberstorm employee is committing these murders and trying to pin it on this dead guy. The killer obviously has access to Cyberstorm's network, and from what I've seen at Cyberstorm, they've got a lot of clever people. I think this is a setup.
You and I are not technical experts, Sergeant. Let's see what the forensics team finds. Decker looked at the assembled officers.
Okay, listen up. We've got to get our hands on more facts. Chief Eichhorn, I'm going to need your cooperation and some of your resources.
Eichhorn nodded.
Anything you need.
Matthew Sobel had an 80-acre estate near here. We should have the search warrant in an hour or so. I'm going to need traffic and perimeter control.
Larson was still absorbing the first sentence.
80 acres?
Decker nodded.
Yes, our Mr. Sobel had considerable assets. A net worth of around $300 million.
Whistles all around.
Detective Seebeck might be right. This case might involve others, but we'll need to follow up on the Sobel lead. Vasquez, I need to know about any disagreements or professional rivalries Sobel might have had with the two victims. I want more detailed interviews with the victims' families. I also need to know anyone else who might have had a run-in with Sobel. Let's get someone at NCAMD to do a workup on him. Straub, I want you over at Cyberstorm with the forensics team. Keep me apprised of any new information.
Decker grabbed a written report from a nearby table and turned to Seebeck.
Sergeant, there's critical information missing from your report on the first murder scene, specifically the cable winch. We need the manufacturer, model, serial numbers.
Seebeck stopped him.
I pulled the evidence unit onto the Cyberstorm scene after the second murder. We were going to follow up.
Now's your chance.
Decker tossed the report and a plastic bag containing a gate key and remote.
I want to know when the winch was purchased and who installed it. Maybe the installer can tell us what other work they've done. Also, find out if a permit was pulled with the city. I want the revised report on my desk ASAP.
Mance looked to Seebeck.
I'll head over to the city permit office, Pete.
Seebeck felt the heat of this professional slight coursing through his veins. He took a breath and tried to keep a clear head. He wasn't used to being closely managed.
All right. I want to revisit the first scene anyway.
The training room phone rang and Vasquez grabbed it. He listened and then called to Decker.
Neil! NSA!
Decker addressed the room. Gentlemen, we're going to need non-FBI out of this room. Chief Eichhorn, plan for an early afternoon search of Sobel's estate.
Will do.
Eichhorn and the deputies soon found themselves being hustled out of their own training room. The door closed behind them, and the five men stood in the hallway. Seebeck gestured to his rejected report.
Hell of a morning.
Eichhorn pointed.
I want to see that revised report before you hand it to Decker.
He turned to the others.
Burkow, Larson, come with me. We've got to scare up some manpower.
They moved off toward the division offices. Mance slapped Seebeck on the back.
Don't let him get you, Pete. I'll hook up with you after the permit office.
Mance headed down the hall. Seebeck watched him go. Just then, two FBI agents emerged from a nearby interrogation room. They had one of the suspects from Alcyon Insurance in tow, an exhausted-looking John Ross. Ross's laptop bag was slung over his shoulder, and he was folding up his flip phone. One of the agents turned to shake his hand.
Mr. Ross, thanks for your cooperation. We know this has been disruptive to your business.
Ross slipped the phone into his pocket.
Disruptive? I just got a voicemail from Alcyon's lawyers. They're threatening a lawsuit, and they canceled my contract. I have messages from two other clients who are putting my projects on hold, no doubt because of you guys.
Be sure to let us know where to get in touch with you if you leave town.
The agent handed Ross a business card.
And don't leave the country.
Ross stared at the card.
Don't leave the country? I have a project in Toronto next month.
He studied the unsympathetic expressions on the agents' faces, then pocketed the card.
Any chance of getting a ride back to Woodland Hills?
Check with the sheriffs, but it might be quicker to call a cab. Thanks again.
Both agents made a beeline for the training room door. They knocked twice and ducked inside, leaving Ross staring after them in the busy corridor. Seebeck called across the hallway.
I see the feds haven't lost their light touch.
Ross regarded Seebeck warily. Seebeck approached and extended his hand.
Detective Seebeck.
I know who you are, Sergeant. You were at Alcyon last night.
You need a ride someplace?
I can call a cab.
Come on. It's the least I can do. It looks like you've gotten the short end of the stick in this whole thing. I'm heading out anyway.
Ross hesitated, then nodded.
Thanks.
Seebeck and Ross drove in silence for a few minutes. Ross was absorbed by a smartphone in his hand. He brushed his finger through several screens, reading intently. Eventually, he looked up.
Interesting.
Seebeck glanced at him.
What's that?
I finally got a chance to read the news. It's nice to know what I was almost accused of.
Seebeck said nothing.
Your murder case is all over the headlines. Look, there's you.
Ross held up the phone to show a news website with a photo of Seebeck at the press conference. Seebeck barely looked.
Well, it's not my case anymore.
They drove on for a few moments in silence.
So you're some kind of computer consultant, is that it?
Yes, I design relational database management systems.
Well, how does a young guy like you get such big clients?
Word of mouth. I'm good at what I do. You look young to be a sergeant of detectives.
Seebeck grimaced.
I got an early start.
They came up on the entrance ramp for the 101 freeway, but Seebeck headed across the bridge to the far side of town.
Sergeant, you just missed the freeway ramp.
I need to stop off somewhere first. Listen, can I ask you some computer questions?
Ross looked uncertain.
What about? That virus at Alcyon. Everybody there was looking to you for help, so you know a lot about viruses?
I already told all this to the FBI. I've been cleared, remember?
Seebeck waved his hand in acknowledgement.
I know, but our in-house guy doesn't have the chops to deal with much more than teen hackers and drug dealers.
Sergeant, the FBI has a cybercrime unit to deal with this. They don't need my help.
It's not the FBI that's asking.
Ross looked to Seebeck.
Ah, I see.
He raised his hands to represent headlines.
Local cop cracks case.
Seebeck looked darkly at Ross.
I'm just trying to stop a killer.
To be frank, Sergeant, you're going to have a difficult time finding whoever killed those men. This is essentially a computer forensics case, and the FBI is better equipped for that.
Seebeck took a chance.
What if I told you I know who the killer is?
Ross tensed visibly.
No, not you.
That's why the FBI let me go?
Seebeck nodded.
What if I also told you that the killer was dead at the time of the murders?
Ross looked puzzled for a moment, but then a look of realization came over his face.
No way.
That's what I need to know. Is it possible?
Holy shit! You're serious?
The feds believe it, but I don't. I think the real killer is over at Cyberstorm and that he's framing this dead guy for the murders.
It's Matthew Sobel, isn't it?
Seebeck cast a surprised look at Ross.
Where the hell did you hear that?
Ross gestured to his phone.
The news said Sobel died this week from brain cancer. He's your dead killer, isn't he, Sergeant?
Seebeck realized he might be in trouble.
Whatever you learn here doesn't go to the media, your friends, anyone. If I even think you leaked this, I'll charge you with interfering with a police investigation. Do you understand?
Your secret's safe with me, but if I were you, I'd be more concerned about Sobel. If that's who's behind this, then there's more going on than just these murders.
How come everyone but me has heard of this Sobel guy?
I'm a hardcore gamer, Sergeant. Sobel was a legend. He helped build the online gaming industry.
Legend or not, how could a dead man have known where to trigger his traps? He'd have to know in advance the exact day he'd be dead.
Not necessarily. Ross held up his phone again. He could be reading the news.
Don't talk science fiction crap.
Sergeant, it's a trivial matter for a computer program to monitor website content. It's just text. All Sobel would have to do is create a program to scan news sites for specific phrases, like his obituary or stories about the deaths of certain programmers. A simple keyword search.
Seebeck considered this. That virus you stopped over at Alcyon Insurance, could that be the program that was waiting for Sobel's death?
Maybe. And it sent packets to thousands of IP addresses.
Packets containing what?
Probably commands.
To thousands of addresses?
Ross nodded grimly.
Jesus, would the feds know this?
Oh yeah, that type of program I stopped at Alcyon is fairly common in computing. It's known as a daemon. It runs in the background waiting for some event to take place. Usually it's something simple like a request to print. In this case, it would be news of Sobel's death, then it activates.
And triggers the killings.
Ross nodded. It's possible.
Just one problem. Sobel couldn't call me on the phone. I got a phone call this morning from someone pretending to be an FBI agent. They told me to check my email, and that's what led me to Sobel. So someone else is coordinating this.
Ross was shaking his head.
It could have been VOIP, Voice Over Internet Protocol.
Seebeck glared at him.
Have I stepped through a fucking time machine? Was I asleep for the last decade or something?
VOIP went mainstream in the corporate world years ago. It saves on phone bills by directing voice communications over internet servers instead of long-distance telephone lines.
So you're telling me this daemon program can talk to people over the phone?
Playing a pre-recorded message over a phone line is easy. The daemon could manage the sequence and schedule the calls based on what it reads in the news.
So it's not actually a computer talking. Someone must have recorded the message.
Probably. Although there are programs that can convert text streams into pretty convincing synthetic voices. Call any airline reservation desk, you'll be talking to a computer pretty quick. It's used to announce flight schedules, credit card balances, things like that.
They drove on for a few moments in silence. Seebeck sighed. Well, at least you got the Alcyon server. That'll put a kink in the killer's plans, whether he's alive or dead.
Ross didn't look comforted.
You really should play one of Sobel's games, Sergeant.
Chapter 9. Herr Oberstleutnant. Over the Rhine was the only first-person shooter to which Brian Gragg had ever become addicted. He'd played and mastered a score of PC action games. All of them had incredible 3D graphics, volumetric smoke, realistic physics engines, 32-voice sound, vast levels, and multiplayer internet features. But OTR was different. Its AI was scary smart. Where enemies in other games poured through doorways wave after wave only to be slaughtered, OTR's AI engine deployed Nazi soldiers realistically. In a house-to-house search, groups of three or four would peel off from the main group, kicking in doors. If you shot one or two of them, or even three, the officer in the street would blow his whistle and shout orders. Then, you'd better haul ass because dozens of soldiers would surround your cottage. They wouldn't storm the place like mindless automatons. Instead, they'd take cover behind fences, walls, and vehicles, and they'd shout in German for you to come out. When you didn't, and of course, why would you, they'd start tossing grenades through the windows or set fire to the house. If you tried to look out a window to see what they were doing, a sniper might cap you. But what was even more fascinating to Greg was that they didn't do it the same way each time. There were smart and dumb soldiers, and varying qualities of Nazi officers. If you hold up in a particularly defensible spot, they might call in a Stug to batter the place into rubble, or worse yet, a Flammenwerfer. And if the siege went on for a while, the Gestapo would arrive to take charge of the situation. And that meant only one thing. SS Oberstleutnant Heinrich Börner. An adversary so wily and twisted, this fictional character had become a cause celeb at the E3 gaming convention. There was a 30-foot color banner of his face hanging over Cyberstorm Entertainment's booth. He was literally the poster boy for evil. OTR's AI cemented the impression that you were fighting against a rational opponent, and a challenging one. Greg appreciated the endless hours of distraction this afforded, particularly since his real-life incident with the Filipinos. Hyder's body had been found in a rail yard near Hobby Airport south of Houston. Hyder had been bound, gagged, and beaten to death, left as a warning to the Carter community. It was at times like these that Greg was thankful for his limited social circle. Few, if any, would be able to connect him to Hyder, but just in case, he decided to lay low for a few weeks. He had about 50,000 or 60,000 in cash on hand at various banks under various identities. Good thing, because he couldn't trade any of the identity database he had copied from the Filipino server with any of his Abkhazian contacts. It was just too hot. He felt a wave of humiliation again. Over 20,000 high net worth identities down the drain. A fortune on the open market. How did they know it was him? Greg had cracked their database through a Unicode directory traversal that allowed him to install a backdoor on their web server. They hadn't properly patched it, and the sample applications were still on the server, so it was a fairly trivial matter to gain administrator rights. He was pretty certain that a network admin was lying at the bottom of Manila Harbor over that simple mistake. But how the hell did they trace the hack to him? Greg ran the exploit through a zombied machine somewhere in Malaysia and a hijacked 80311G wireless connection in a Houston subdivision. Even if they tracked the file transfer to the destination IP address, how did that lead them back to him? Even if they beat the hell out of the poor suburban sap whose Wi-Fi access point he'd hijacked, that wouldn't tell them anything. Nonetheless, Greg had spent a couple sleepless nights waiting for his front door to be kicked in while pondering the question. He just couldn't figure it. What had he missed? Only recently did it occur to Greg that he might have been the Filipinos' only partner in Houston. By staging the attack from a Houston domain, Greg had made a pathetically obvious mistake. The Carter, Loki from Houston, Texas, was an obvious suspect. But as the days slipped by, it became apparent that the gang was either satisfied that Loki was dead, or that they had no idea of Greg's real identity. Until he was positive, Greg spent his waking hours hiding in the rough industrial space that served as his apartment, playing endless hours of OTR. And OTR was quite a challenge, after all. Greg usually chose the Nazi side, and his preferred weapon was the sniper rifle, which he'd used to pick off newbies from a hiding place in a bell tower or garret window. He combined this with a liberal amount of verbal abuse, using hotkeys to launch the taunts built into the game.
I've seen French schoolgirls shoot straighter.
His cable internet connection usually gave him a ping in the 20 to 50 millisecond range, which was a major advantage against lamers with pings of 150 plus. Their in-game avatars would hesitate as Greg dropped them. He never tired of piling up the bodies in front of his hiding place. Deathmatch OTR was a distributed network game. That is, one of the players hosted the game map off of his machine and made the match available for anyone to join over the internet. There were deathmatch clients available that listed all available matches by geographical region, each machine sending out a message that it was available. The server listings numbered in the thousands. Since Greg had been playing OTR off and on for the last 6 months, well before the Filipino problem, He was intimately familiar with every game map. He knew that if he tossed a potato masher grenade from the end of the park in the St. Lo map, it would land just behind the vegetable cart on the far end, killing anyone hiding there. He knew a place on the Tunisian map where he could jump up onto shattered rooftops and snipe people with impunity. It took an experienced jumper to make the leap without falling to one's death off the balcony. Frankly, Deathmatch had begun to lose its luster until Cyberstorm released the custom map editor. Since then, a score of popular custom maps had appeared in the Deathmatch server listing. Most of these maps were the out-of-control Rambo fantasies of 14-year-old boys with ridiculous numbers of mounted machine guns and no logic in the placement and design of fortifications. Greg knew he could do much better, but he didn't have the inclination to learn the scripting language used to create the maps. No money in it. So it was with low expectations that Greg downloaded a new custom map named Monte Cassino. The reasonably historic name was unusual, since the 14-year-old crowd usually named maps something like Fuckmeister Shitfest. Greg quickly found a server named Houston Central running the Monte Cassino map. Since it was geographically local, it gave him a killer ping of 20 milliseconds, and he joined the deathmatch already underway. The moment the map loaded, he noticed differences from other custom maps. First off, he wasn't even allowed to join the Axis team. The map only permitted internet team play for the Allied forces. The Germans were bots. It was humans against the AI, which irked Greg because he loved playing the German side. They were the villains, after all. Likewise, respawning was different in this map. It wasn't a straight team match where you respawned elsewhere after dying. Instead, it was described as an objective map, where you stayed dead until the last member of your team died, or until you defeated all the Germans, at which point the map reset and everyone was alive again. Also, this map had radically different terrain and textures, as though it was all done from scratch. The map consisted of a steep mountain topped by the ruins of a large Benedictine monastery. The scenario description said U.S. heavy bombers had struck the monastery. The resulting ruins turned out to be a maze of shattered walls, charred wooden beams, and entrances to cellars. It provided excellent cover for the Germans, and the designer placed MG-42s with interlocking fields of fire along the approaches to the hilltop. The Germans also had light mortars to kill you if you hid behind boulders. It was as if they'd registered the coordinates of all the good cover in advance, which was something the Germans might actually do. As a result, Greg was determined to beat it. It was quickly apparent that a pack of lone gunmen could not take the monastery. It required an orchestrated attack. It took an hour of goading other teammates using the chat window, but Greg finally convinced them to coordinate their attack instead of running hell-bent for leather up the hill. With some experimentation, they soon discovered that half the squad could draw fire from the krauts, while the other half of the force outflanked them on the left, using the steeper incline for cover. If they ran, they'd be spotted and cut down. But if they crawled on their bellies, they could usually get to within grenade-tossing distance of the outer fortifications. Once the grenades exploded, they'd charge into the ruins and the rest of the battle would be room-to-room fighting. By this time, the squad distracting the Germans would be mostly dead from mortar rounds and heavy machine guns, so they couldn't contribute much. It was a tough slog, and Greg was still at it 2 days later. He hadn't slept and had eaten very little, but he would not disconnect from the Houston Monte Cassino server.